When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The following is a presentation of the Premier Dance Network.
I'm James, and this is The Stage Right Side with James Whiteside, where we'll dive deep into the dark world of dance and come up on the bright side. Oh, that's terrible. Welcome to The Stage Right Side with James Whiteside. I'm your host, James Whiteside. What a surprise. And I am here with fabulous British choreographer, Arthur Pita.
Hello, James. How are you?
I'm excellent, thank you. Well done. Right on cue. So here we are. We're in quarantine. We're on, you know, various continents. And we're connecting over Instagram Live. We're doing a live taping again. And this has been really fun to connect with my overseas fellows. So thank you for joining me today.
Huge pleasure.
What time
an
is it?
An honor. There? It's an honor. It is now like just 10:05, maybe?
10:05. Goodness gracious.
Yes.
Isn't it your bedtime, Granny?
You know, actually, it's getting later and later. The whole schedule has just shifted. Mm. But as long as you get your 8 hours sleep, I think that's what's the most important thing. No, but we start watching stuff because there's actually a lot to do during the day. So we actually start watching stuff at about, right about now, like 10:30. And then I can easily go until like 1:32. And then I wake up at 10.
A night owl. I love it. I'm
totally.
I'm nocturnal as well.
Totally.
Oh my goodness. The morning is really a rough time for me. So here I am. I'm drinking an iced coffee, which is really just the way to go. What are you
divine.
Drinking?
Divine.
Oh, do you have a cocktail?
I did have a glass of water, but it's now holding the phone. But I, actually, earlier on, because today we cleaned the house. Thursday's clean the house day. And it literally takes a whole day. It's exhausting. So at the end of the day, we had a lovely gin and tonic. And then I had a beer. I actually had a Corona for dinner.
Oh my God, a beer for dinner? That's not food, but it sounds
yeah.
delicious.
Yeah, no, with dinner.
So tell me this.
Yeah.
Has anybody heard if Corona is suffering, you know, the beer company or whatever?
Well, I heard that some people in America, in like out there in America, stopped buying Corona because they thought it was the virus.
Of course, the British media published that.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I heard. Defamatory.
But, you know, I was trying to find out for ages what Corona meant. Do you know what it means in terms of the coronavirus?
It's the type of virus. It's like the little guy.
Crown.
Yeah.
Because it's a ball and then there's a thing sticking out. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's,
we clearly don't know the technical terms. Good thing we're not scientists.
But it kind of makes sense. Like Corona. It's like Italian, like Corona, you know.
Yeah. You know, a coronation. Yeah. The crown.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Let's get down to business. I want to get, you know, the basics out of you. So tell me, I like to do this with my guests because I can't assume that everybody knows how fabulous you are. So tell me a little bit about yourself, where you're from, how you got into your work. All right.
Okay. So I was born in South Africa by Portuguese parents. So my parents came from Madeira Island, which is a tiny little island off Portugal between Portugal and Morocco. And I grew up in South Africa, born in 1972. So I kind of hit the peak of interesting, of hitting stuff that was interesting to me around about maybe the 80s. Mm. So I guess the big influence would have been John Travolta in Greece was my obsession. And a leaflet, a little flyer came through our post box offering disco dancing lessons and Latin American dancing lessons. So me and my sister went for lessons to the local dance school, which is called Diana Moore Dance School. And that's where it all started. It was like 5, 6, 7, 8. And you just did, you literally started by just moving your hips side to side for 8 counts. So you did 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then you did double 1, 2, 3, 4. And just to loosen things up. And actually, I'm very grateful for that early training because I think it freed me up. And then later on, I started doing ballet and contemporary, sort of more formal training. I wouldn't say it's untechnical, but it's a much freer technique.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. Ballet itself is so technical that it can lock you up. So I'm really grateful for the extracurricular training I had as well. Okay, wait. So how long were you in South Africa?
Until I was 19.
Okay, so you're not British at all then. Cool. After all this time.
Well, yeah, no, not really. I'm Portuguese. I mean, I've lived in London now longer than I lived in South Africa.
So what do you call yourself then? South African still?
Definitely not. No, I would say I'm Portuguese. I'm a Portuguese man living in London. That's what I would identify as.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Gosh, that's much more interesting than I'm from Connecticut.
Well, I mean, it's tricky because I hope this phone's going to stay. It's tricky because even in South Africa, I never felt like I belonged there because we were already immigrants living in South Africa.
So I was
born in South Africa, but I didn't understand why my parents would want to immigrate from Madeira Island, which is this beautiful island, to South Africa during the time of apartheid, where it was really quite rough and scary. But there was a country of tension.
So did you register that as a child?
No, I didn't, actually. It was quite hard. So there's something now in Johannesburg called the Apartheid Museum. Mm-hmm. And I went there when it first opened, I think in the late 90s. And mm-hmm. I was just so upset and extremely moved because all of a sudden there was this museum full of the history of apartheid, and half of it I didn't know. Or not, I didn't know about it, but half of it I didn't see. So there were rooms with big projected footage of all the, I guess, the violence and the upset that was going on in the country. And we were, because there was so much propaganda, we didn't see that footage. So I didn't know what was going on, really, most of the 80s. And it was really upsetting. And, it's a very interesting museum because when you go in, if you go with a friend, they separate you to a white or non-white entrance. And you get like a random ticket. Huh. So we could go together and you might get like a non-white entrance and I might get a white entrance. And then you have to experience that division and then you meet up like halfway through. And then, so it's a beautiful museum. So important. So yeah, that upset me. And then I realized that I didn't know what the hell was actually going on.
Hmm. Well, if it makes you feel any better, nobody really knew what was going on during the 80s.
I don't think so. Yeah, apart from like Cyndi Lauper and Madonna, maybe.
So, the disco happened. When did you start more formal ballet training?
Right. So then, yesterday I used to do disco training, disco dancing competitions, all that kind of stuff. I came to London to do some competitions. I actually won the UK British Under 16 Boys Championship. Then it was called freestyle dance, right?
It's so fierce.
I know, it's hilarious. Then I became very, very interested in contemporary dance. So in South Africa, all of a sudden on TV, there was this documentary. And it was a documentary about Sylvie Guillaume. And it was Sylvie Guillaume doing In the Middle, Somewhat Elevated, with William Forsythe kind of choreographing around her and then like showing bits of the pieces. And I used to watch that probably about 5 times a day. I was obsessed. And I was like, there's got to be more. So I eventually enrolled for something called the Johannesburg Art Ballet Drama and Music School. And I went and auditioned. And all I knew is that I just had to try and like get my legs high because I just wanted to be like Sylvie. So when we did like the Grand Battement in the audition, I was quite loose and my legs would like whack up. And I just remember the teachers like laughing and going, okay, who is this? And I got in and then my life really changed because this amazing contemporary dance teacher called Sonia Mayo, who taught us contemporary dance, was just the most amazing. You know, everyone has that teacher that inspires them and is like the light. Mm-hmm. And she was totally that. She was amazingly knowledgeable about the body. She was actually the first white woman from South Africa to dance in the Elvin Ailey II company. So she was quite groundbreaking, but she had a lot of that, the Graham technique, the Cunningham technique. And she was way ahead of everyone in the early 90s teaching Pilates. So we kind of got amazing training from her. And then she would show us videos of interesting work like Matzek and, you know, the Graham stuff and the Pina Bausch stuff. And, you know, she would just like expose us to this amazing work. And that kind of opened the doors, and I was just completely curious.
Have you seen that they're making a documentary about Showgirls? Have you heard about it?
No, really?
Yeah, I think it's just, you can look it up. It's just Google Showgirls documentary, and it's just about
the movie. Do you love it?
Do I love it? Are you kidding me?
How amazing. I mean, it's
I can't even believe it, still. Every time I
think
I
it's great
it, like,
because it's unintentionally
it.
Hilarious. You know,
yeah.
And I think that's what's so fantastic about it. You know, like it just came out like that. It's amazing. It's amazing.
Perfect. It's a beautiful thing. if you haven't seen Showgirls, the movie, please, please, please watch it with a group of friends. Have a drink or two. Make sure that you're over 17 or 18 or whatever the age is to watch a dirty movie. It's not dirty. It's you know.
What's your favorite moment?
Fabulous. The pool.
The dolphin sex in the pool.
Yeah. The like crazy backwards wiggling she does. Unbelievable. Also, anytime she eats like a bag of chips or French fries, like the way she eats her food is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think the pool is my favorite. I watch that and I think like, did the director let that happen? Did the director make that happen?
Does she do that with Carl McLaughlin? I know.
I adore both of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, he's amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Amazing.
So, he was, I mean, obviously he was Agent Dale Cooper in Twin Peaks, but in the newest series, his character as Dougie really just cracked me up.
Amazing, right? He's hilarious.
Yeah,
he's hilarious. And actually, there's another amazing sex scene in that in series 3 Twin Peaks when he's having sex and he starts flapping his arms. She's like on top of him and he's just.
It's Naomi Watts, right?
Yeah, Naomi Watts, and it's just brilliant. Oh my god, I'm trying to get Matthew into that to start from the beginning of Twin Peaks. Mm. Season 1, I think you can skip season 2 and just go straight to... I think you should watch season 1, Fire Walk With Me, and then straight to season 3.
That's a good suggestion. All right, so homework for listeners. Watch Showgirls if you're of age, and watch Twin Peaks from the beginning. So series 1, skip 2, go to the movie Fire Walk With Me, and then the newest series.
Yeah.
You will not be sorry. Yeah. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Okay, back to you, all right?
Okay.
So can you tell me a little bit about your first experiences with choreography?
You know, I started basically straight away because when you have to do freestyle dancing, right, disco dancing, the competitions, you basically had to, you would work with somebody, but you would really devise your own routine. But then what you would do is... once you got into the finals, you would line up at the back and then you would have 30 seconds to show your best of.
Huh.
So I always had to try and come up with what my tactic was always to try and do what everybody else wouldn't do, you know,
Like what?
So everybody, most people would like run straight forward to the judges and then like whack it out and then like run back with a cheeky look and then like join the line. Uh-huh. So I might sort of prowl from the back. Do you know what I mean? And come slowly and then like attack. You know what I mean? And then also like when you're dancing in the heat, you would literally dance all at the same time. The judges walk around like with a notepad looking at your number. Uh-huh. So basically everybody would always try to go straight to the judges. And I thought, well, if everybody's doing that, what if you step back?
Uh-huh.
Because then you have the space. And also like there were certain tactics, like people would go to the dance floor and most people would hit a pose and be still. Uh-huh. So the judges can see you. But then I would choose that moment to just walk around the space looking at everyone with uh-huh. that attitude. So it was always in me to try and find a way in that wasn't what everyone else was doing. And then I just became more and more curious about the beginnings of things. And we started doing group routines, like formation teamwork.
Yeah.
And where you could choose music and choreograph. So I always asked... actually, her name was Amber, and she's fantastic. She's one of the teachers, and we worked together. And I'd always ask her, oh, can I please choreograph a beginning on the group? I have this idea with something like drums or something. And so I'd really enjoy creating the introduction, which was something before you kind of hit the routine. To me, that was the more interesting part. And basically, I mean, it's a continuation of that, really.
Cool. So... that being said, did you ever do any formal choreographic training or anything or anything like that?
I would say formally when I went to London Contemporary Dance School, then we started proper choreography class.
Okay.
And again, another amazing teacher, guider in my life called Victoria Marks, who actually lives in Los Angeles. She makes fantastic work. She's American. And she was just the most fantastic. She would never say that you did something wrong. She would just, and often when the class had to give feedback, she would just say to us, you're not allowed to say, I like and I don't like, which is what most people go like, I like that bit, I don't like that bit. She would just say, what do you see? You know, and that was more helpful in terms of the feedback. Because if someone would say, oh, I see a man standing in the space hitting an arabesque. And you go, well, I don't really want them to see that. I want them to see more than that. And someone might say, oh, I see a man in the space who is lost. And then that's more what if that was your aim, that is what there would be a good feedback. So it was kind of an interesting way of working, but she was just absolutely amazing. It was just about structure and about time and space and floor patterns and just amazing, amazing exercises, you know, which I loved.
Yeah. So what would you consider to be your first big choreographic break?
Ooh, 'cause I started, the first break really was as a student at the Place Theatre. And I was a student and there's a season called Resolutions, which is for younger choreographers to have a platform. You should have been really out of school to make it. But, John Ashford, who is the theater director, had seen a piece I'd made on the students, which is kind of a political piece, about South African, about apartheid. I made this piece and he really liked it and I wanted to make something else. So he said, why don't you do the resolution? So that was quite a big thing. Mm. And basically, I took the text of Peter Handke's Offending the Audience, which is a play, and I choreographed this piece where they all wore one point shoe. I don't know why. It was a student thing. But it was like one point, because I figured that I wanted to kind of mix contemporary and ballet, and I was so into the Forsyth influence. So I kind of thought that if you had a point shoe on one foot, the other foot could grip the ground. So you could get the benefit of a contemporary and a, so when you wanted to be up, you could be up, but you could also do the grounded stuff to have the opposite foot to support you. And we did this crazy piece. I had a camera in the wings, which was on, and then a big monitor on stage showing what was happening in the wings. So it was all about them, like breathing and like, yeah. And then sometimes they would come and they would like lip sync the text into the camera whilst other people were on stage. So it was just, it was kind of this, out there, but this it sounds was a very, thing.
This had to be the 90s.
So 90s.
This sounds full outrageously on, 90s.
It was full on 90s.
I
it
love
was
that.
Like 1992 or 3, yeah. And then we had muscles exaggerated, painted on their bodies. And then I had like baseball like grease under the eyes, and then with like really stiff buns.
Sounds it was quite a look.
Yeah, it was quite a thing. I mean, it was, you know, it was real student work, but it was kind of a break. And I think it was something that gave me the confidence, I guess, to not be scared and to try something and, you know, and keep going for it, I guess. Yeah. And that really, in a slowly kind of opened the doors, because then it started building. But I think the big professional one, I would say, was when I had to choreograph an opera for Francesca Zimbello, who's an amazing opera director, huge opera director. She now is artistic director of Washington Opera. And she's like tough New York, like you can't get by any, you know, any shit with her. And she just called me up. I'd worked with someone, assisted somebody on a job, and she just called me up and said, oh, do you want to choreograph La Boheme at the Royal Albert Hall? And I was like, of course, you know, it'd be amazing. So of course, it was an enormous space in the round. I think like 150 chorus, and I had like 12 dancers. And then I hired actually another 6 or 8 roller skaters, because we did the big cafe scene. And because the Royal Albert Hall is so huge, I didn't know how we were going to get all these to set the scene up. So I said, well, what if we have roller skating waiters? So we had these roller skating waiters, dancers, and this chorus. And then she basically, the rehearsal started, and she said, okay, Arthur, so go. And I was like, what do you mean? She's like, go, choreograph it. And I was like, what? And I was like thrown into the deep end. But somehow, you know, your survival, you know, instinct kicks in. And I learned so much, and she was just so great and enjoying this. And we had this great rapport, and I kind of did 3 jobs with her after that. And I learned a lot about just the making of theater, just about being on your game, knowing what you're doing, the room, the atmosphere in the room, getting everybody on. And that then opened more and more doors, because then I did Carmen at the Royal Opera House. And then that's what led me to being in the canteen. And then I met somebody there. And then I did one of a piece of my own company at the Limbury Studio. And then Edward Watson came and saw that piece. And he liked it. And he wrote about it. He was interviewed and he spoke about it. And then I had an idea to do the Metamorphosis. So then I asked him. And then it kind of came. And then that's how it all sort of rolled.
So yeah, can you tell? Exactly. Let's talk about Metamorphosis a little bit. It's yes. The Metamorphosis, correct?
The Metamorphosis.
There
by
must
Franz
be
Kafka.
The. All right. So
it's the. Yeah.
Give us the elevator pitch of the show.
Well, you can watch it tomorrow night. Well, actually, it's 7 p.m. Tomorrow.
It.
And I'm going to plug it. Tomorrow, 7 p.m. at
really
British Standard
that.
Time. If you just click on the Royal Opera House Facebook page, or the Royal Opera House YouTube channel, and you can watch
well,
it
this
starting
will, I mean, by
night.
The time this airs yeah. in the podcast, it'll be over. But for those watching live tonight, tomorrow yeah. at 7 p.m. British time, yeah. go to the Royal Opera House website, royaloperahouse.org or something, just Google it, and you can yeah. watch a live performance.
But you can actually just click it on, it's just going to be straight on their Facebook. So easy. You just go on their Facebook page and it's there. And it's
fabulous.
Just,
so
yeah,
7
so
p.m.
easy.
So what is that here? That's 2 p.m.
2 p.m.
And 2 that's, p.m. The time, that's my class time. So I don't think I'll be able to check in until like, how long is the show? Like
yeah,
an hour and 15
but
minutes?
I think you should watch. I think it's kind of better at night. It's like
is it going to live on for a little bit?
Yeah,
or?
It'll live okay. on for 30 days.
Oh, beautiful. Okay. Oh my God. I'm so excited.
So you got 30. Did you see it at the Joyce Cemetery?
I did. Well, I was, okay. I was blown away. I saw that was the first thing I had seen of your work. And I mean, unbelievable. Just oh, I was,
thank you,
as the children say, shook.
Shook. yeah, it's one of those things, you know, it's for some reason, I think with that piece, what really happened was that the energy of everybody in the room, sometimes when everybody comes together, and I feel like we had that experience with The Tenant, like you just come together and everybody's at different points in their life, and somehow the piece kind of brings up the emotion, and everybody entered into it and allow themselves to be possessed by the characters, and then the thing happened. But I didn't really, none of us really knew, I had a plan for it, but I didn't really know if it was the right way, yeah, because I hadn't done it in that way yet, but I felt like it was the only opportunity to do it that way. So I thought, well, let's just do it and we'll see what happens. And Edward Watson was just amazingly open, and it was completely the right time for him because he had already kind of ticked, you know, his list off as a classical dancer. And so he was just very, very curious. And he entered into it so bravely, and everybody looks after him, and everybody looked after each other, because it was quite, you know, I like to do improvisation. So, and his character has to be kind of zero status to get to that place. And in a weird way, I kind of knew that he would do the insect. I knew that the insect, the bug that would be very easy for him. But I wasn't sure whether that he would find, you know, the human, the man behind it, you know, because in a way there's a you have to remove the mask and still see it through the soul of his eyes. And the very first day that we started it, and he just, I think I just gave him an exercise, like, you have to get out of bed and stand there, and, you know, this is like the same thing you do every day. And the way he just sat up and did it, I was like, wow.
So can I interrupt you for a moment?
Can
you give
it.
Just the story, like in a nutshell, of the metamorphosis, so people have a little bit of background knowledge?
Okay, it's about a character called Gregor Samsa, who one day wakes up, and actually the first line of the book is he wakes up after troubled dreams to find that he has been transformed into a giant bug, basically an insect.
So when I saw the metamorphosis at the Joyce Theater, which is a great theater in New York, I remember writing something about it on my Facebook or on Twitter, and Ed had messaged me back, you know, saying that he was glad I saw it or something. And I was like, oh my gosh, wow, cool. I'm a huge fan. And yeah, so let's move on a little bit. I know a couple of...
The final number for the film of Sunshine on Leaf with Dexter Fletcher, the director, because I'd worked with his wife, actually, who was an opera director. And that was for DNA Films company. So Alex Garland wrote Ex Machina, and I was actually, I was away, I was on holiday, and all of a sudden I got this phone call from the film company saying, oh, we have this film, would you like to read the script? And, you know, so there's a dance scene in it. So I got the script and I was like blown away. It was so amazing. It's like,
if you haven't seen the film Ex Machina, I think you can view it on, you know, Hulu or Netflix or something. It's on some service. Just figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. And actually he's just written a TV series that's just come out now with Sonoya.
I've been watching it. Yeah.
I haven't started. Is it good?
I'm enjoying it very much. It's called Devs, and it's a Hulu original, and it's all about quantum computing and ethics, and it's really fabulous.
Yeah,
he's, and a little bit of, you know, intrigue and all that.
Yeah, he's amazing. So basically, then I had a phone chat with Alex Garland, and, you know, I was like, And he's like, oh, we need this, and we need to release the scene, and it's this, and he was very specific about the music that he wanted, and the kind of moves that he wanted. He wanted very retro disco dancing moves, and I was like, well, very helpful that I've done disco dancing. So I literally made up the routine in my kitchen, and then went in, and I think we had about two or three sessions with Oscar Isaac and Sonoya, who was a dancer. Already,
Oscar Isaac is so hot. That's all.
Just beautiful. I mean, yeah. So you know, in that scene, he wears like a hoodie top, and when he arrived on set, it was all like zipped up to the top, and I was like, no, you have to like unzip that. Like, we need to like see this man, this beautiful man. And then and Alex Garland was like, really? Do you think so? And then Oscar was so nice. He was like, do you think? And he's like, do you think it'd look? And I was like, listen. Just it works. It's right for the character. Like, we just need to enjoy. He was so amazing. Such a nice guy. Yeah, and so basically we got on set and we just kind of did it. And I didn't think it would have been the thing that it was. But Alex is so grateful and he's so happy for that scene because he feels it's actually a very important part in the film where the uncertainty of that character kicks in to like high octane, but it was absolutely so much fun to do, and an amazing effect to be a part of that. We did work on I did work with Sonoya on the robot. She was the robot, and we did a load of stuff, but actually he didn't want any of that. He wanted it to be completely, because he wanted them to read that the AIs were completely human, so that obviously when she goes into society at the end, that it's completely convincing. And then I actually had a very interesting conversation with him, and I said, "Do you really, like, as a writer, do you really believe that this is actually even possible? Do you think it's possible that an AI could enter into society eventually the way?" And he said, absolutely. He said, we are just the Neanderthal version of ourselves. He said, we will destroy all of this, but we will make AIs and they will take on our DNA basically and continue as us. And that he truly believes that.
Pretty dark, but also, you know, could be worse.
Right? I know.
I mean, I don't believe that our existence is a right. I'm really grateful that I can exist on this planet, but, you know, we don't own it, so moving right along.
Exactly. Well, it's showing now, isn't it? You know.
Yeah. It's been showing for a while.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, basically, ever since humans started crawling out of their caves or out of the sea, we've just been ruining things left, right, and center. But we've created a lot of beauty as well. Just look at... That is a beautiful film.
So really, beautiful. Really. So beautiful. He's such an amazing director with such a clear vision. And it's got a great... And what I love in that film is the music, the score. It's such a beautiful, elegant score. Like, it doesn't interrupt the film. It just takes you on that ride. And it's so... Oh, it's just beautiful. And Sonoya, who's an amazing... She just came out of Scottish Ballet... straight out of Scottish Ballet, and she started acting, and she got that role, and that scene was, so I was with her on that first scene, which was that dance scene, and she was just so amazing, so tuned in, so amazing, and her career has just gone, boof, you know, she's like, Hollywood, you know, full. Yeah, so I'm really happy for her.
Absolutely. All right, I want to move forward a little bit. I refuse to have this podcast be 17 hours long, so we have to keep it moving.
Okay, right, keep it along. Going. Let's do it.
I would like to skip a bunch of works and talk about The Tenant.
I would love to talk about The Tenant.
Arthur and I worked on a show called The Tenant, based on a Roland Tapor novel. How did this start? So I started speaking with the Joyce Theater in New York, and I had pitched some sort of jazzy, very New York-y, quasi-story ballet, essentially. And they said, you know, we we want you to meet Arthur Pita. And I said, okay, sure. And we met up at an Au Bon Pan on Broadway.
Yeah.
And we sat up in their little loft space eating hard-boiled eggs and drinking too much coffee. And he said, we just sort of chatted with the staff of the Joyce and to each other, obviously. And yeah. And he said, have you heard of The Tenant? Have you ever watched the Roman Polanski film or read the book? And I said, I haven't heard of either of those things. And he pulls out of his satchel, you know, a book. And you gave me the book then and there, no? Or did maybe it was
The Joyce people? I didn't even know when I was going to meet you that it should be The Tenant. But as you were talking, because basically you were saying, and I remember you were wearing your white, I think it was like a white leather jacket.
Yes, I have a very chic white leather jacket.
Very, yeah. And the fact that you really wanted a coffee. And I was like, he needs his coffee. He's got class.
Oh, yeah. I was like having a hissy fit that I couldn't get a coffee. I like couldn't believe the service.
Yeah, exactly. And you were in this power jacket. This like Joan Collins power moment. I loved it. And then you were like, I want it to be something that has a murder, something that's dark. But I would love something that's got also the jazz score. And then you mentioned about 20 collaborators that you wanted to be in it. And I think those things just ticked off in my head. And I'd always had The Tenant in the back of my mind. And I was like, I think this is it. This is the moment. It just like came. And that's when I just said it. Have you read The Tenant? Because if you would be perfect for us. And then you did.
So I'm going to give you the elevator pitch for The Tenant now. So The Tenant, the novel written by Roland Topor, is about a Polish man who lives in Paris and is looking for an apartment, having a real rough time trying to find an apartment. This is a very relatable tale about city living.
Yeah.
Finds an apartment, finds out that the previous tenant had committed suicide by jumping out of the window, finds out she actually isn't dead yet, and is actually in the hospital. And he has this strange fascination and decides to go and visit the stranger in the hospital to find out if she's close enough to dying that he can move into the apartment. So it's all got this dark absurdity to it. Right. She lets out this blood-curdling scream in the hospital, ends up dying. It's very strange. He meets a woman at the hospital who ends up being his quasi-girlfriend. Throughout the book, he becomes more and more obsessed with learning about the previous tenant and slowly sort of becomes possessed by the idea of her. And things keep happening, very strange occurrences. He thinks the neighbors are trying to kill him, and he ends up jumping not once but twice from the window of the same apartment, ending up in the hospital where the previous tenant ended up. And you don't know, you end up in the end of the book wondering if he's passed away like she has, or
I'm
if
back.
Hi, she's back.
Sorry, I just you froze, and then
you made the right choice. I just finished telling the story of The Tenant.
So, oh, brilliant.
That being said, we had a bunch of meetings basically, and we decided to do a little workshop, blah, blah, blah. That all happened. This is a completely different process for me. I really enjoyed it, and I think it's served me greatly in all of my work. So I just want to thank you for that, because it's given me a lot of perspective and knowledge, frankly. Just to keep things moving, the most interesting, other than doing the actual shows, the most interesting anecdotes about The Tenant are from our Lake Placid residency. So I don't even know where to begin here. We go up to Lake Placid, and just for fear of defamation, and we're going to keep it pretty light on that end, we're just going to talk about how sick I got. So sick. We're creating this show, which has a lot of dark themes, and my character in the show gets deathly ill. And I'm doing, like, we were creating the scene in which I go out to get the medicine from the doctor, and I come back and I'm shaking, and I have this whole, like, sickness scene. And I was like, oh my gosh, my head hurts. And, you know, I started feeling like chills and things.
Yeah.
And I got incredibly ill. And I had a crazy fever. I was vomiting and it was just horrible. I went to a doctor in Lake Placid and I was prescribed what turned out, well, okay, I should have known because I go to the doctor and he's in a pair of gray sweatpants with a fanny pack over it. Like when the doctor walks in with like a pair of Skechers, like gray sweatpants and a fanny pack, I should have just turned around and left. But I was very ill and I needed to figure it out. So he prescribed me some medication, which I later found out was meant for children, like 8 years and under.
My God.
So I did not get better, and I had a throat infection. The throat infection ended up getting worse and worse because...
Ross Leclerc's there.
Oh, hi, Ross. We're getting everybody in here.
Yeah.
So basically my sickness just kept overpowering the antibiotics. So I literally just was in this dungeon room asleep for a week and
getting worse and worse. And yeah. I don't know why we even waited that long. I think we just say, oh, you know, it'll kick in the antibiotics.
Because I was already on medication, and any other time I've gotten strep throat or a throat infection, I just take the antibiotics and I'm fine. Hi, Nina.
She's like, that's a scary time. Yeah.
Oh, it was terrifying. I mean, it's funny to talk about, but
yeah, no,
I devolved to a point where I couldn't really move. My fever was so consistent. So they figured after 2 weeks, they sent me back to New York. And I mean, everyone was so nice during
I was there. Right, basically, Cassie and I were the ones that put you in the back of the van with Will, who's our production manager, who is an amazing
angel.
But you were literally you were shaking. You had like lost weight. You were gaunt.
Yeah.
And you were hunched over, and this was happening. Because you went to the accommodation across the road, so mm-hmm. that you could be out of whatever the dungeon that we were in, and we made a bed at the back of the van. I remember just thinking, I thought, I really wonder if you're going to make it to New York, because I'd never seen someone that ill, and I was really, really worried. And we kept phoning Will all the way to New York until your doctor literally just walked you to the hospital, right? Straight away.
Yeah. So I remember when you all put me in the back of the van, I remember being like freezing and I had a pair of sunglasses on and I just started crying because I was so grateful that you all were so kind and had set up this way for me to get back to my doctor in New York. And I don't know, it was just really touching and it made me cry. Because I mean, I was so tired. I had been like really gravely ill for 2 weeks at that point.
Yeah.
So I get back and I go directly to my doctor, who's an angel, and he's just my general practitioner. And he looked at me and took my temperature and he literally took me by the wrist and the shoulder and walked me to the hospital.
Yeah.
And he walked in and he said, we were in the emergency room and he said, I need someone to see him right now.
Yeah.
Like this moment, like no wasting time,
yeah.
no waiting for anything. The staff was like, holy shit, what is happening to this guy? Cause I was just like shaking and I weighed like a pound.
Yeah.
They figured out that, from taking like basically kids penicillin, the sickness had overpowered everything and I had essentially gotten a bacterial infection in my blood from having a throat infection. So
Jesus.
My whole body was affected and it could have really affected my brain. And so I couldn't really even think or see, honestly. And so they set me up with like an antibiotic IV. So I was there. I was there for I think 3 or 4 days trying to flush out this bacterial infection in my blood. And at one point they thought that they wanted to do a Spinal Tap or something, and I was coherent enough to refuse the Spinal Tap.
Oh,
I was
my
like, it's
God.
Fine. I know it's just like an infection. Just relax. Yeah, it was insane. And then all of that knowledge of being sick really informed my performance in The Tenant.
Well, it was
made it very believable.
Yeah. I just couldn't believe, like, when we were messaging you and you were like sending us pictures of you in the hospital. And the fact that in the piece, there's like a nurse attaching, like a cabrilla attaching the bag to you. Like, so you were like living the scene, like life, art, life, all of that thing was happening.
And this was the second time it happened, because the first workshop we did, I also got ill. I got a throat infection, which it's just wild. Like every time we'd come back to this piece to do a workshop or to do more creation, I would get very ill. It was very strange. It was spooky as hell.
I know.
So really insane. But
you always lived, and you're still with us now, thank God.
Yeah, I lived, and I still live. I'm living,
and you,
man.
You lived, but you bounced. I was amazed also when you came out of hospital, and we had like another week to finish the piece. And I was like, we're going to just have to maybe come back later. There's all this discussion. You were like, no, I think I'll be fine.
Like, no,
and literally, there's like one day where you were like fragile and everyone was like tiptoeing around you. And then the next day, like up until lunch, you were like, and then all of a sudden, like in the afternoon, you were like straight away, like lifting Cassie, like smooching Cabrilla. And I was like, and you just have like, I saw the moment where you kind of like bounced back. It was quite amazing to see that. And of course, when we came back in the fall, so it's the excitement. I get excited. When we came back in the fall to do the piece, you were like so like in amazing shape, because you were in the season and
it was amazing. We're doing this. That was, I was like, we're not fucking around anymore.
No.
My franche. So it's 5:56 and we've just been waxing poetic over here. And I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me on the stage right side. It's a fun place to be on the stage.
It's an honor. You know, actually, the other day, Matt and I were just listening to your chat with Mark Morris.
Isn't he just the best?
Yeah, Matt's reading his book at the moment. So I was like, oh, you got to listen to James Whiteside, stage right side of James Whiteside with Mark Morris. And it's a great one. It's really good.
I mean, talk about wrangling a cat. I like doing that interview. I remember just being like, what is he talking about? But it was also very poignant at the same time, which was very confusing as an interviewer.
Yes. Like he gives and he doesn't give.
Yeah. Yes. And he'd zip over to somewhere else and he'd be like, all right, I'll follow. I'll bite. It was really fun. It kept me on my toes. Yeah. Let me tell you.
No, it's great.
All right. Thank you so much. Everyone,
you're
follow
amazing,
Arthur
James.
Peter's work. I love you, Arthur. You're such a treasure, and I look forward to A, doing The Tenant again.
Yes,
so
please.
Stay tuned for that world. B, creating new work in the future. We have to make that happen. It's important.
We have to. Let's
hair
do that.
Flip.
Always.
Well, talk to you soon, hopefully. Ah, there she is.
The double. Simone.
So good. Great artwork by Kristen Cimarroni. All right. Nice. Much love.
Bye, darling. Lots of love to you.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
In this election, we each face a question. What kind of country do we want to live in? We choose freedom. The freedom not just to get by, but get ahead. The freedom to make decisions about your own body. We believe in the promise of America, and we're ready to fight for it. Because when we fight, we win.
I'ma keep on running, cause a winner don't quit on themselves.
Paid for by Harris for President.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.